The task of making a genealogy of the items that constantly changed was very difficult and in some cases impossible and pointless. Moreover, some items are not allowed to be photographed, or their likeness and image preserved in any manner. There was no means of infringing on the alien patent. Some items never repeated the same shape twice, others cycled through dozens of odd shapes, sizes and dimensions and then repeated familiar patterns and traits. If the items never left the ship, where did they go? When an item was carried off the ship, it was no longer on the ship, a logical conclusion. Except the committee knew there was nothing about the ship or its contents that was logical. Therefore, applying logic to find a solution to all the questions that any of them had was their biggest drawback. On one of the panels on the craft, located in the area believed to be the control center, there were icons depicting everything that belonged to the alien ship. The size of each icon was roughly 1/2 inch square. The area that encompassed all of the icons was approximately 3 feet by 3 feet. There were 5,184 icons. When the alien items transformed, the icons that represented them transformed at the exact same time. They were synchronized as if they were one. When items were taken off the ship, the icons representing them gave off a soft greenish glow. Some scientists believed that the icons were exact working replicas of the items they depicted. There was no way to find out because the icons were inaccessible. Unlike our human-type control panels, which have access to instrumentation via an opening in the back, front or side, for servicing or upgrading, there was no means of entry to the alien instrumentation panel. The spaceship resembles a kind of living metallic organism. It had no visible rivets or screws to hold things together, nor were there any seams, joints and overlaps of any kind. Nor was the location of the windows and doors perceptible. The ship and its contents seemed to be more organic than synthetic. There were no hinges, latches, knobs, rollers or wheels, only a smooth, even, one-piece skin that encompassed the whole craft. The ship extracted infinitely more information about the researchers than the researchers could ever hope to collect from the ship. That was a foregone conclusion by the committee. There was no mechanism that was clicking away in the craft to indicate the craft was gathering information on the scientists. But the craft adapted to some of the awkwardness of the researchers as they fumbled around like the blind, attempting to extract some understanding of what they were dealing with. The ship often gave clues on which items activated certain devices and openings on the craft by making the item the scientists were working with give off a glow or sound or both. If and when a particular scientist was slow at picking up on the information that dealt with a specific project they were working on, they received subtle hints from the objects themselves. There was a correlation to how the ship helped scientists and the way we sometimes solve problems as humans. If we study a problem long enough, many times a solution presents itself in a dream or inspiration. Presumably the answers come to us from our subconscious mind. On the ship, the subconscious mind remains unconscious and so does the conscious mind. Nothing makes any sense. Therefore, it was theorized that the answers, when they did come, came from the ship or from its brood, the gadgets. The subconscious mind, like a navigational computer, works non-stop to help us humans better understand and function in the three-dimensional reality we are confined to on this planet. The alien craft was multidimensional, which is a contradiction to all we humans know and understand about physics. The alien ship seemed to comprehend the shortcoming of the human inquisitors, and provided them with a few solutions to their queries via baby steps. Why did the aliens dump so much mysterious stuff on Earthlings all at once? Did they overestimate the ability of humans to comprehend an advanced society as their own? Highly unlikely, in evidence of their superior and completely beyond our understanding technology, it would seem they are incapable of making that kind of misjudgment. Next headline, technology, where does it come from? How much new technology was gathered from that particular alien craft and then funneled into practical earthly use remains unknown. At what rate the technology was dispersed is also unknown. Assuming that the documents don't exaggerate, how were the scientists able to reverse engineer anything at all from such a complex ship? Maybe the answer is not so complicated. Our aircraft are designed on the principles of the aerodynamics of birds and insects. Yet, our best engineers cannot build a bird or an insect. Despite the complexities associated with birds and insects, we are able to extract enough information from them and use that information to build flying craft such as airplanes and helicopters. How did we integrate alien technology into our own? Like things manufactured in factories, the finished product is the result of many dissimilar processes. The raw materials come from one source and the knowledge of how to process is from other sources. It's not necessary to know where one technology ends and another one begins, or for that matter, from where it came. The importance is the end result. The technology or bits of information coming from covert committees and labs are collected and mixed with other bits of information from other sources like universities and corporations, which spend billions of dollars every year on scientific research. That committee is just one of many sources that are secretly working on who knows what. And truthfully, who cares? As long as new technology keeps coming and improving the way we live our lives. One scientist believed that he cracked the puzzle on how the alien things vanished and then returned to the ship. He felt that the icons were not only symbols on the control panel but also the actual items. He proposed that the items that were carried out of the craft and studied by the scientists were disposable replicas of the icons. If that were true, the lifespan of the replicas would be approximately 72 hours. He theorized that after 72 hours the items dissolved into the atmosphere, leaving no evidence that they ever existed. That theory fit well with the reports made by people who claimed they were abducted. Abductees reported that aliens inserted metal objects into various parts of their anatomy, but when they were asked to produce these objects by the skeptics, they were unable to do so. Up to that point, no one on the committee had proved that the alien items vaporized, but it was one of their better hunches at that time. It also explained why no one has ever found an alien artifact, and why there is no evidence that aliens visited the planet. It answered the big question that UFO skeptics always ask: if aliens are visiting Earth, where is the alien litter? One answer to that question was clear to some: the aliens aren't litter bugs. However, not all alien objects followed the 72-hour vanishing rules, and little was discussed about those items. The possibility that the icons replicated endless copies of themselves with the same ease as microbiological cells dividing was astounding. What kind of world would be possible if we learned to harness a fraction of that magic from the ship and applied it to food and energy production? After an item was taken out of the craft and it expired, only then did another one appear and take its place, which was a drawback for human applications. There was no method of knowing if the icons replicated new items every 3 days automatically, or if only the ones that left the ship were renewed. They were unable to test the theory by marking the items because the alien material was impervious to human markings. The moment Frankenstein became part of the inventory of the ship, an icon of him appeared on a separate panel. If the theory held that the icons were the prototypes of all the items on the ship, then perhaps the committee could subject the body to many kinds of experiments and limiting the need to harvest additional damaged humans to experiment on. To test that theory, the scientists made a drastic decision: kill the body. They could not test that theory on any of the other alien objects because they were indestructible. The body, on the other hand, was flesh and blood, or so they believed it was. But after it was modified by the alien ship, they were not sure. The scientists presumed that the body could be damaged or killed. None of the scientists volunteered to kill the body, even though the body was in a vegetative state, no brain activity, and presumably not a living entity. Therefore, the committee made a request for a professional assassin, a hitman, to do the dastardly deed. The request was approved by those mysterious people that ruled over the committee members. The committee was told to draft a procedure on how they wanted that assignment carried out. The details were sketchy and not very clear, other than the body was shot in the head at close range using a revolver. The hit was done somewhere outside of the secret compound by a hitman that believed he had killed a man over money due the mob. The scientists did an autopsy shortly after the body was killed, expecting to find and remove the alien life support creature that was wrapped around some of the human organs giving life to the body. But the thing was gone. The autopsy did not find anything mysterious or unusual about the dead body. Apparently it vanished like the other alien gadgets. The body showed the same amount of decomposing that a normal human cadaver undergoes shortly after death. The study raised more questions and answered none. It did not prove that the alien objects decay, only that the human body with the alien contraption remained mortal. The icon of the body vanished from the panel on the ship. No eulogy was given or sorrow shown from anyone who worked with the body. Instead, most of the scientists were relieved at not having it around anymore. Once the body was gone, a noticeable jump in morale occurred, but those happy days were short. Orders from the top stipulated the desire to produce and add to the inventory additional bodies. Next headline, alien contact. One morning, one of the committee members revealed to his colleagues that he had been abducted the preceding night. That revelation brought a sense of excitement to the rest of the members. He told his colleagues that the abductions had been going on before he came to the program. He then told them that they also have been abducted and taken many times since their childhood. The aliens allowed him to remember that abduction because, as the aliens put it, it was time. He was abducted while in bed during the night from his home. There were other humans on the ship with him who had been abducted moments before they took him. They allowed him to observe and for the first time in his life not be the subject of whatever procedure they were there to perform. The other humans with him that night were not so lucky, and he had to endure torment they were put through. He did not have freedom to move about the ship and was told telepathically where to go, and he did. The aliens had total access and control of his subconscious mind. Under the alien command, his body moved as if he were a robot. All he could do was mentally sit back while his body instantly took psychic commands from the aliens. He was not sure which of the aliens was talking to him or how many aliens there were on the ship that might have been influencing his movement. The aliens were friendly and treated him kindly and constantly assured him he did not need to be afraid. When he had a question and they were willing to answer it, it was answered quicker than it formed in his mind. If it was a question they would not answer, they told him so, and then let him know that possibly he would be given an answer to that question sometime in the future. Even when their intentions were to never reveal a certain secret, they avoided using negative responses with him. It was a good thing that they had him on autopilot, he told his colleagues, because his knees were like jelly and he couldn't keep them from shaking. After working on the alien project for more than 25 years, he could not believe how unprepared he was to meet the aliens face to face. He nearly wet his pants just thinking about his abduction. He knew that what he experienced that night was only the initiation and that he was not expected to understand any of the things that went on. He did remember that there were four adult men there with him. They were not completely paralyzed. He watched two of them turn their heads and look directly at him. He recognized the fear he saw in their eyes. It was the same fear he had in his. He told his colleagues that the stars are much brighter when viewed from a vantage point above the Earth's atmosphere, and he rambled on about how giddy he felt despite his fear. While the aliens did their work, the craft was parked somewhere in Earth's orbit. He wanted to go to one of the portals for a better look at the stars and to see what Earth looked like from space, but they told him he could not during this visit. The aliens were strictly business, unlike a doctor's office here on Earth, where a patient has time to read through several magazines before the visit begins. There was little waiting for the anxious souls who were in the alien ship. One at a time, they got up and walked into a room that seemed to be as bright as the sun itself. There was no sound, and only the individual who was summoned knew what the aliens were saying or commanding them to do. After entering the bright room, strange objects, some similar to the ones he experimented with back at the lab, materialize all around the man and attached themselves to various parts of the man's body as if he was magnetic. Soon after, and seemingly from nowhere, like all the gadgets, a frail-looking alien appeared, and with the help of two other aliens that had been standing there the whole time, in freakishly rapid motion assisted the man onto the table. Everything in the room was polished and orderly. Instruments seemingly appeared, did things, and then evaporated out of the area when they were done with whatever they were doing. The aliens rarely handled the objects. The objects seemed to have autonomy, or perhaps the aliens controlled them telepathically. The room the four men walked into that night was similar to the one that was aboard a craft they had in their possession, except that they never witnessed instruments permeate from the walls or appear in flight out of thin air. That was the only room that was familiar to him. This ship was much larger, 8 to 10 times larger. He physically did not see many aliens, but somehow he knew there were dozens of them on the craft. He watched the aliens work at speeds that made him dizzy, and it was the most frightful thing he ever witnessed. All he could think of was getting out of that place. It was ironic. He waited his whole life for this moment, and now that he had it, he didn't want to ever experience it again. Although, after the initial shock of seeing humans manipulated in ways that would have left them paraplegic had it occurred in the human realm, and they walked away with no apparent harm, he became less apprehensive about the ordeal. After hearing his story, some on the committee wondered if they should go through regression therapy to explore what kind of experiences they had with the aliens and to confirm that it did happen. None of them knew for sure if they had been abducted. They only had the word of their colleague. The committee member, Bill, who was abducted and revealed that fact to his colleagues, advised them not to go through regression. He told them that from what he had seen, that he could attest that the procedures the aliens used on the abducted were extremely painful, and that they were better off if they did not relive the experience. Despite the horror the four men were put through, Bill was ordered how precisely the aliens and its machines performed their duties. In a bizarre way, it was miraculous and comical, he told his colleagues. Had he not been terrified, he might have died from laughing at what he saw. The way the aliens tossed the men around like rag dolls was perversely amusing. It was like being in a den of mad magicians. Strange objects flew and hovered around the room, sometimes stopping over the table where lay the abducted, perform a jig or ritualistic dance, then move about the room swaying and dancing in the air like shaman. Some aliens looked human, or perhaps they were human like him, on some kind of internship, observing the madness around them as he was. If they were human, they were at a more advanced level than he, because they walked around freely and causally without apparent fear. Some instruments appeared to be organic and moved and looked like large worms, about the diameter of a vacuum cleaner hose. They emerged from what looked like solid surfaces, yet left no hole after emerging or after retreating back into the surfaces. Regardless of what was performed on the abducted, the outcomes were never hit and miss, it was known. The aliens literally split one of the men down the middle, cutting him completely in half like a side of beef. Seconds later, they had put him back together. All this was done with no blood loss or visible scars. The blood appeared to be solidified, frozen. It did not flow, spill, or squirt out from the mutilations or body parts when one of the men was dismembered. One man had his arms and legs cut off with some type of laser. He was conscious the whole time, screamed and yelled in horror but did not pass out. Presumably the aliens kept him from passing out or going into shock. Bill had the feeling he was going to vomit but didn't. That too was controlled by the aliens. The aliens didn't tell Bill that this was a demonstration for him and possibly others, but that was the only conclusion he came away with. For the abducted, it was strictly outpatient. There was no lying around convalescing under the care of nurses for days or weeks. Once they emerged from the surgical room, they were ready to be returned to their bedrooms, or to wherever they were originally picked up from. Because of the pain that was endured by the abducted, it may have seemed like they were there for hours, but from what Bill could recall, none of the abducted were under the knife for more than 2 or 3 minutes. The actual time it took may have been longer or shorter, since the passage of time is difficult to judge while inside an alien ship. Next headline, civilians used for experimentation. There were no problems obtaining injured or sick people for experimentation by the committee. Thousands who have no immediate family or friends fill the rooms of nursing homes and state hospitals across the country and the world. This was the pool of choice for the committee. The nursing homes were chosen over the hospitals because, as one committee member said, they're like warehouses of the damned. The lucky ones are barely aware of their surroundings. Many are only alive because of all the drugs that are pumped into them daily by the nursing homes. The majority in the committee believed that experimenting on these people was more humane than the life they had while at the nursing homes. Taking them out of the nursing home was like rescuing them from a fate worse than death. "Nothing can be worse than a nursing home," anonymous quote. "Even in failing health and barely conscious, some of the old people perked up when one of the technicians working for the committee came there to pick them up. At the beginning of Operation Grey Hair, not real code name, the committee set up a medical team to intercept certain critically ill patients from unnamed nursing homes. The old and decrepit were a pitiful sight. No one on the committee had any intention of adding to their misery, and so only those who were not cognizant of their surroundings and on the verge of dying were used to experiment on. It sounds horrible that anyone would do such atrocious things to defenseless people, however many of them were miraculously healed from their physical and mental ailments. Most of them suffered from severe forms of dementia, arthritis, diabetes, liver and kidney problems, and when they were returned to the nursing or convalescent home, they were in excellent health. That became a problem and a dilemma for the committee, which had not anticipated those types of results. The committee had expected to be making runs to the city morgue, not returning rejuvenated elderly people back to the nursing home. Furthermore, the elderly made a fuss about going back. The super secret underground committee was not set up to be a way station for re-establishing the lives of the miraculously cured elderly. Nor did they want to turn them loose into society. They wanted to monitor them for a few years to gauge their progress and verify if their healing was permanent or temporary. The program was put on hold until they sorted out the can of worms they had opened. Returning people who were fraught with problems of the aging when they were taken away and then healthier than most of the attendants that cared for them eventually caught the attention of the media. One such episode nearly blew the lid off the whole covert operation. The committee moved quickly and severed all links that could lead the events to them. They then implemented a new policy and relocated those who were still in the pipeline of being cured, giving them new lives and identities far from where they might attract attention. The elderly themselves never suspected a thing. They assumed that when they became ill, paramedics came and took them to a local hospital. They had no reason to think otherwise. There was no mention in the documents on how the committee handled the memory question. Perhaps they erased their old memories and implanted new ones. The scientists were in possession of alien equipment that could do that. The nursing home would have been notified that the patient died and was cremated. Extensive background checks were done to make sure there was no family or friends alive that might take an interest in their newly revived kin before bringing anyone into the program. The media soon lost interest when they failed to find anyone who could give them proof of what happened. A few healthy old people, those returned to the home before the committee changed that policy, with no story to tell, was not enough to keep the media interested for long. Next headline. The myth of human autonomy. Understanding the aliens was a slow and difficult process, however. That was not the committee's biggest challenge. Instead, it was the arrogance that had developed over the years amongst committee members due to their untouchable status. That kind of power was difficult to control, and it threatened to undo the covert operation many times because of the power struggle between the members. They were not invincible, although that had become the mood. What happened at the nursing home could never have been tied directly to them. They were under far too many layers of bureaucracy to ever get caught. What concerned their superiors was the possibility of the media giants taking a serious interest in what took place at the nursing home and snowballing it into a full-blown inquiry, and possibly resulting into a real Senate investigation. With the equipment the committee had in its possession, they had the means to become more secretive than they already were. Technically, they were invisible. Only a handful of people in the world know of their existence, but with the use of the alien equipment they would become literally invisible, like the Invisible Man. For a time they were fearful of using the arsenal of alien gadgets they had up their sleeve, especially outside of their comfort zone, outside of their protected base of operations. They were afraid that if they bungled a mission and exposed their operation that they and ultimately their whole organization could be destroyed. All those involved with the program, committee members and the scientists are shadowed by what is appropriately called the cleanup team. The job of that team is to dispose of them along with their equipment in a matter of minutes should a mission be compromised and exposure to the program imminent. Killing one or all of them on the spot was not a last resort, but a certainty if they were unable to be removed from the scene expediently. The part about expediently bothered the committee members the most. How can the scientists or committee members in the field be untouchable and at the same time dispensable? It was a difficult reality for the prima donna committee members to swallow. As a result of that reality, expendable, they limited their exposure and avoided whenever possible risky assignments outside of their compound. Fear of being found out was not the only factor that held them back. There were other reasons they delayed taking the alien equipment off the base and into the homes of unsuspecting civilians. The collective belief in the sanctity of one's home did stir in the souls of the committee members. The ability to enter a person's house and go into their bedroom without their knowledge took getting used to. What made the whole thing acceptable was that the committee was aware that thousands of people are visited, some call it violated, by aliens every day. A few people know they are being abducted, but the vast majority of humanity has no clue that it is happening at all. The committee felt compelled to enter the realm where no man had yet gone, a place where up until then, the aliens alone inhabited. We humans place the highest value on privacy. We naively think that our innermost thoughts belong only to us. We are living in a fantasy, an illusion with such thoughts. Privacy of body and mind is a human delusion, according to committee documents. The committee members came to that realization shortly after they were brought into the program, and have since concluded that one cannot break a trust of a fellow human being when truth and trust are illusions. After a few months or years, no one knows how long the harvesting of old people was continued. The committee decided that people from nursing homes were still the best and safest to test and experiment with. The old people were docile and ambivalent to the handling, poking and prodding, of the scientists who experimented on them. However, the scientists went about it differently than they did with their first trials and abducted their subjects from the care facilities. The black op technicians gained entry by using the alien device that allowed them to permeate solid objects and walk through walls. They used an unmarked passenger van to carry them and the equipment they needed to the site. The alien gadgets easily fit into a briefcase with room to spare, and the gadgets behaved for the most part, which was not always the case. The nursing home they picked for their first field assignment was located in a rural area, miles away from a large city. They didn't have operatives at the nursing home as they had in the past. This was a test to see how they would perform in an uncontrolled environment. They had simple instructions: abduct a patient, and take her back to the base or just drive around for a short time, then return her to the exact spot they picked her up from, 2 hours later. They hoped to accomplish this without anyone at the home knowing that she was missing. They had no plans to do anything to her, other than give her a 2-hour ride in the country. They were to return to the base, a temporary hideout, if they had unforeseen complications. They arrived at the destination an hour after nightfall. One of the committee members who drove in a separate unmarked car entered the building first. He entered through the front entrance posed as a state inspector, and told the attending nurse at the front desk that he was there to perform a surprise inspection. He was equipped with all the necessary credentials, and if they called any of the health departments for verification, committee members monitoring the calls coming and going from that building would have intercepted the phone call. While he kept the staff distracted, three of the committee members in the van looked for a dark area close to the building and out of view of the front office.